Chapter 5. But that night, remembering the words he had cherished for 2 years, tell her how we became friends. It will comfort her, as it comforts me, he related everything. It gradually seemed to him, as if in his maturity he had recovered a mother. It gradually seemed to her, as if in her bereavement she had found a son. During his stay in England, the quiet garden into which he had slowly and painfully crept, a stranger, became the boundary of his home. When he was able to rejoin his regiment in the spring, he left the garden, thinking was this indeed the first time he had ever turned his face towards the old colors with a woman's blessing. He followed them so ragged, so scarred and pierced now, that they would scarcely hold together two quarter bras and liney. He stood beside them, in an awful stillness of many men, shadowy through the mist and drizzle of a wet June forenoon, on the field of Waterloo. And down to that hour the picture in his mind of the French officer had never been compared with the reality. The famous regiment was in action early in the battle, and received its first check in many an eventful year, when he was seen to fall. But it swept on to avenge him, and left behind it no such creature in the world of consciousness as Lieutenant Richard Doubledick. Through pits of mire, and pools of rain, along deep ditches, once roads, that were pounded and plowed to pieces by artillery, heavy wagons, tramp of men and horses, and the struggle of every wheeled thing that could carry wounded soldiers, jolted among the dying and the dead, so disfigured by blood and mud, as to be hardly recognizable for humanity, undisturbed by the moaning of men and the shrieking of horses, which, newly taken from the peaceful pursuits of life, could not endure the sight of the stragglers lying by the wayside, never to resume their toilsome journey, dead, as to any sentient life that was in it, and yet alive, the form that had been Lieutenant Richard Doubledick, with whose praises England rang, was conveyed to Brussels. There it was tenderly laid down in hospital, and there it lay, week after week, through the long bright summer days, until the harvest, spared by war, had ripened and was gathered inches, over and over again the sun rose, and set upon the crowded city. Over and over again the moonlight nights were quiet on the plains of Waterloo. And all that time was a blank to what had been Lieutenant Richard Doubledick. Rejoicing troops marched into Brussels, and marched out. Brothers and fathers, sisters, mothers, and wives, came thronging thither, drew their lots of joy or agony, and departed. So many times a day the bells rang, so many times the shadows of the great buildings changed. So many lights sprang up at dusk, so many feet passed here and there upon the pavements, so many hours of sleep and cooler air of night succeeded. Indifferent to all, a marble face lay on a bed, like the face of a recumbent statue on the tomb of Lieutenant Richard Doubledick. Slowly laboring, at last, through a long heavy dream of confused time and place, presenting faint glimpses of army surgeons whom he knew, and of faces that had been familiar to his youth, dearest and kindest among them, Mary Marshall's, with a solicitude upon it more like reality than anything he could discern, Lieutenant Richard Doubledick came back to life. To the beautiful life of a calm autumn evening sunset, to the peaceful life of a fresh quiet room with a large window standing open, a balcony beyond, in which were moving leaves and sweet-smelling flowers. Beyond, again, the clear sky, with the sun full in his sight, pouring its golden radiance on his bed. It was so tranquil, and so lovely, that he thought he had passed into another world. And he said in a faint voice, "Taunton, are you near me?" A face bent over him. Not his, his mother's. "I came to nurse you. We have nursed you many weeks. You were moved here long ago. Do you remember nothing?" "Nothing." The lady kissed his cheek, and held his hand, soothing him. "Where is the regiment? What has happened? Let me call you mother. What has happened, mother?" "A great victory, dear. The war is over, and the regiment was the bravest in the field." His eyes kindled, his lips trembled, he sobbed, and the tears ran down his face. He was very weak, too weak to move his hand. Was it dark just now? He asked presently. No. It was only dark to me. Something passed away, like a black shadow. But as it went, and the sun, oh the blessed sun, how beautiful it is, touched my face, I thought I saw a light white cloud pass out at the door. Was there nothing that went out? She shook her head, and in a little while he fell asleep, she still holding his hand, and soothing him. From that time, he recovered. Slowly, for he had been desperately wounded in the head, and had been shot in the body, but making some little advance every day. When he had gained sufficient strength to converse as he lay in bed, he soon began to remark that Mrs. Taunton always brought him back to his own history. Then he recalled his preserver's dying words, and thought, it comforts her. One day he awoke out of a sleep, refreshed, and asked her to read to him. But the curtain of the bed, softening the light, which he always drew back when he awoke, that she might see him from her table at the bedside, where she sat at work, was held undrawn, and a woman's voice spoke, which was not hers. Can you bear to see a stranger? It said softly. Will you like to see a stranger? Stranger, he repeated. The voice awoke old memories, before the days of Private Richard Doubledick. A stranger now, but not a stranger once, it said in tones that thrilled him. Richard, dear Richard, lost through so many years, my name, he cried out her name, Mary, and she held him in her arms, and his head lay on her bosom. I am not breaking a rash vow, Richard. These are not Mary Marshall's lips that speak. I have another name. She was married. I have another name, Richard. Did you ever hear it? Never. He looked into her face, so pensively beautiful, and wondered at the smile upon it through her tears. Think again, Richard. Are you sure you never heard my altered name? Never. Don't move your head to look at me, dear Richard. Let it lie here, while I tell my story. I loved a generous, noble man. Loved him with my whole heart. Loved him for years and years. Loved him faithfully, devotedly. Loved him without hope of return. Loved him, knowing nothing of his highest qualities, not even knowing that he was alive. He was a brave soldier. He was honored and beloved by thousands of thousands. When the mother of his dear friend found me and showed me that in all his triumphs he had never forgotten me. He was wounded in a great battle. He was brought, dying, here, into Brussels. I came to watch and tend him, as I would have joyfully gone, with such a purpose, to the dreariest ends of the earth. When he knew no one else, he knew me. When he suffered most, he bore his sufferings barely murmuring, content to rest his head where he rests now. When he lay at the point of death, he married me, that he might call me wife before he died. And the name, my dear love, that I took on that forgotten night, I know it now, he sobbed. The shadowy remembrance strengthens. It has come back. I thank heaven that my mind is quite restored. My Mary, kiss me. Lull this weary head to rest, or I shall die of gratitude. His parting words were fulfilled. I see home again. Well, they were happy. It was a long recovery, but they were happy through it all. The snow had melted on the ground, and the birds were singing in the leafless thickets of the early spring, when those three were first able to ride out together, and when people flocked about the open carriage to cheer and congratulate Captain Richard Doubledick. But even then it became necessary for the captain, instead of returning to England, to complete his recovery in the climate of southern France. They found a spot upon their own, within a ride of the old town of Avignon, and within view of its broken bridge, which was all they could desire. They lived there, together, 6 months, then returned to England. Mrs. Taunton, growing old after 3 years, though not so old as that her bright, dark eyes were dimmed and remembering that her strength had been benefited by the change, resolved to go back for a year to those parts. So she went with a faithful servant, who had often carried her son in his arms, and she was to be rejoined and escorted home, at the year's end, by Captain Richard Doubledick. She wrote regularly to her children, as she called them now, and they to her. She went to the neighborhood of Aix, and there, in their own chateau near the farmer's house she rented, she grew into intimacy with a family belonging to that part of France. The intimacy began, in her often meeting among the vineyards a pretty child, a girl with a most compassionate heart, who was never tired of listening to the solitary English lady's stories of her poor son and the cruel wars. The family were as gentle as the child, and at length she came to know them so well, that she accepted their invitation, to pass the last month of her residence abroad under their roof. All this intelligence she wrote home, piecemeal as it came about, from time to time, and at last, enclosed a polite note, from the head of the chateau, soliciting, on the occasion of his approaching mission to that neighborhood, the honor of the company of cet homme ci-justement célèbre, Monsieur le Capitaine Richard Doubledick. Captain Doubledick, now a hardy, handsome man in the full vigor of life, broader across the chest and shoulders than he had ever been before, dispatched a courteous reply, and followed it in person. Traveling through all that extent of country after 3 years of peace, he blessed the better days on which the world had fallen. The corn was golden, not drenched in unnatural red, was bound in sheaves for food, not trodden underfoot by men in mortal fight. The smoke rose up from peaceful hearths, not blazing ruins. The carts were laden with the fair fruits of the earth, not with wounds and death. To him who had so often seen the terrible reverse, these things were beautiful indeed, and they brought him in a softened spirit to the old chateau near Aix upon a deep blue evening. It was a large chateau of the genuine old ghostly kind, with round towers, and extinguishers, and a high leaden roof, and more windows than Aladdin's palace. The latticed blinds were all thrown open after the heat of the day, and there were glimpses of rambling walls and corridors within. Then there were immense outbuildings fallen into partial decay, masses of dark trees, terraced gardens, balustrades, tanks of water, too weak to play, and too dirty to work, statues, weeds, and thickets of iron railing, that seemed to have overgrown themselves like the shrubberies, and to have branched out in all manner of wild shapes. The entrance doors stood open, as doors often do in that country, when the heat of the day is past, and the captain saw no bell or knocker, and walked in. He walked into a lofty stone hall, refreshingly cool and gloomy after the glare of a southern day's travel. Extending along the four sides of this hall was a gallery, leading to suites of rooms, and it was lighted from the top. Still no bell was to be seen. "Faith," said the captain halting, ashamed of the clanking of his boots, "this is a ghostly beginning." He started back, and felt his face turn white. In the gallery, looking down at him, stood the French officer, the officer whose picture he had carried in his mind so long and so far. Compared with the original, at last in every lineament how like it was. He moved, and disappeared, and Captain Richard Doubledick heard his steps coming quickly down on into the hall. He entered through an archway. There was a bright, sudden look upon his face, much such a look as it had worn in that fatal moment. "Monsieur le Capitaine Richard Doubledick? Enchanted to receive him. 1,000 apologies." The servants were all out in the air. There was a little fete among them in the garden. In effect, it was the fete day of my daughter, the little cherished and protected of Madame Taunton. He was so gracious, and so frank, that Monsieur le Capitaine Richard Doubledick could not withhold his hand. "It is the hand of a brave Englishman," said the French officer, retaining it while he spoke. "I could respect a brave Englishman, even as my foe, how much more as my friend. I also am a soldier. He has not remembered me, as I have remembered him. He did not take such note of my face, that day, as I took of his," thought Captain Richard Doubledick. "How shall I tell him?" The French officer conducted his guest into a garden, and presented him to his wife, an engaging and beautiful woman, sitting with Mrs. Taunton in a whimsical old-fashioned pavilion. His daughter, her fair young face beaming with joy, came running to embrace him, And there was a boy baby to tumble down among the orange trees on the broad steps, in making for his father's legs. A multitude of children visitors were dancing to sprightly music, and all the servants and peasants about the chateau were dancing too. It was a scene of innocent happiness, that might have been invented for the climax of the scenes of peace which had soothed the captain's journey. He looked on, greatly troubled in his mind, until a resounding bell rang, and the French officer begged to show him his rooms. They went upstairs into the gallery from which the officer had looked down, and Monsieur le Capitaine Richard Doubledick was cordially welcomed to a grand outer chamber, and a smaller one within, all clocks and draperies, and hearths, and brazen dogs, and tiles, and cool devices, and elegance, and vastness. "You were at Waterloo," said the French officer. "I was," said Captain Richard Doubledick. "And at Badajoz." Left alone with the sound of his own stern voice in his ears, he sat down to consider, what shall I do, and how shall I tell him? At that time, unhappily, many deplorable duels had been fought between English and French officers, arising out of the recent war. And these duels, and how to avoid this officer's hospitality, were the uppermost thought in Captain Richard Doubledick's mind. He was thinking, and letting the time run out in which he should have dressed for dinner, when Mrs. Taunton spoke to him outside the door, asking if he could give her the letter he had brought from Mary. His mother, above all, the captain thought. How shall I tell her? "You will form a friendship with your host, I hope," said Mrs. Taunton, whom he hurriedly admitted, "that will last for life. He is so true-hearted and so generous, Richard, that you can hardly fail to esteem one another." If he had been spared, she kissed not. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.